accession number 10218, Reel 1.
Commodore Brothers, Reel 1. When the Battle for France broke out in May 1940, can you tell me what unit you were serving with and in what capacity, please?
Yes, I was a flight commander in 32 Squadron at Biggin Hill and had been in the squadron since the autumn of 1936, which was an advantage in that by then I'd acquired quite a reasonable amount of flying experience. And when the balloon went up on May the 10th, we'd just got a new CO, John Worrell, known as the Baron, and he asked me to lead the squadron, as he was brand new, on our first raid, which was on the airfield at The Hague, Epenberg Airfield, and we were told to go and ground strafe it because the Germans had landed paratroops there, so we were told. But on arrival there, we found the airfield was littered with transport aircraft, all of which were burnt out in the middle, and clearly had been the airfield had been retaken by the Dutch, and they destroyed the Ju-52s. And so we searched around for something to shoot at, and found a Ju-52 in good order, hidden between some hangars, and duly set that on fire, which proved to be a very unpopular move because the Dutch had kept that one to escape to England in. But we didn't learn that till sometime later. And after that...
Did you have much contact with the Dutch?
No, not at that time. We saw the odd aircraft on patrol there, but... they seemed to be equipped in those days with some sort of American monoplane fighter, which I can't remember what type it was.
Did you see any devastation in the Netherlands?
Oh, yes. Well, there were fires burning on Rotterdam and that sort of thing. And in the city areas. But that was very short-lived because after a few patrols such as that, the next thing was we kept being sent off to France on a daily basis. We'd take off about half an hour before first light from Biggin Hill. And our first trip was to a place called Moursilly, a little airfield in Belgium, on the Franco-Belgian border.
Can you spell it?
Yes, Moursilly. And 615 Squadron were there at the time, and they were in a pretty poor state of morale because the road was jammed up beside the airfield with refugees, and one of the sergeant pilots hadn't reported for duty that morning, and they'd gone to find him in his bunk and found he was lying on his back with a knife in his chest. Somebody had knifed him during the night.
Did they ever find out why?
No. Whether it was somebody trying to rob him, a refugee, or whether it was a fifth columnist, or nobody ever knew. But it had rather shaken their nerves a bit that put your head down wasn't necessarily a very safe thing to do. Anyhow, we were there just for the day, and we operated a few patrols from there, and then got back to Biggin after dark again.
And did anything happen on those patrols?
Saw nothing, and it was pretty chaotic. And it was even more chaotic later when the sort of following day we went to Abbeville, and there was no we did a patrol Lille, Valenciennes, and finished up landing at Dieppe for fuel, again a little tiny airfield. But communications were appalling. We couldn't get any instructions from anybody. We were trying to make contact with the headquarters, find out what they wanted us to do, and we couldn't get through to them or get any sense. We were having to refuel our own aircraft from jerry cans, and having to start them ourselves, and we were starting these Hurricanes on handles, which meant that I would get into my aircraft and two of the chaps would wind the handles and start it, and then we'd leave it idling and I'd get out and go and start it, help start his, and so it went along till we'd got all 12 going. And there was no food. We begged food. One of our chaps spoke fluent French, and we begged food from a farm. He managed to get a loaf of bread for us, but that was about it. It was a scene of general chaos, in fact, and that went on until I suppose finally sometime about the 21st, 23rd of May, we finally they cancelled all the trips to France, and we remained on local air defence from then on, operating either from Biggin Hill or from Hawkinge as a forward base.
Were you ever actually in combat in France?
Yes. The first patrol we did from Abbeville, we stumbled across a bunch of 109s going in precisely the opposite direction, and one of them whizzed over the top of my head so close that you could see the oil streaks on the aircraft and that sort of thing. And you did a sudden realisation, good God, it's the enemy. And then the combat started, and I managed to shoot one of them down. But one was quite startled by the whole thing at that stage.
Can you remember how you shot it down?
Well, it was quite strange, because the chap who passed over my head went into a steep turn, as I did, to see where he'd gone, and he came round in a great curve, and I was on the inside of the curve, and as the Hurricane could turn much better than the 109, and got him in the sights, and fired, and was surprised to see that the thing caught fire, and went down through the clouds and burning merrily. But
what are your feelings when you see that happen?
First feelings were, my goodness, this is going to annoy the rest of them. I'd better look out. Where are they? But I think one of the things that was, if you like, a saviour of my life in a lot of respects, was at the very, when I first joined the Air Force, we were lectured by a chap called Taffy Jones, who was a First World War ace of some renown. And he stuttered terribly, and Taffy warned us that there was going to be a war and that we were going to be in it. And I make no apology for his language, this is how he put it. He said, when you get into your first fight, you'll be fucking frightened. Never forget the chap in the other cockpit is twice as fucking frightened as you are. And that was a very good morale booster. I thought, I was pretty frightened, and I thought that poor German must be even more frightened than I am.
But when you see somebody go down in flames, who you shot down, do you feel a sense of triumph, or do you think some poor devil's burning to death in a...
Well, you don't think much of the individual, because you don't think you've hit him, and you hope he'll bail out or something. It's the aeroplane you've hit. The one time I did feel sickened was later in the war, when we had cannon, and one of my cannon shells went straight into the cockpit of a Focke-Wulf 190, and one knew then you had blown a chap to bits, actually, which was a bit sick-making. But normally it was more of a game, if you like, that you were outwitting and shooting down an aircraft. You were hitting metal and knocking a wing off, something like that.
Were you always heavily outnumbered in the Battle for France?
Not particularly so, I suppose, because we didn't meet all that number of aircraft. When we did, the numbers were really not very important. And the weather seemed to be... I have great recollections of a lot of cloud in the sky and chaps emerging from cloud and finding a Dornier 17 or something, and before you could get at him, he'd hidden himself in cloud. But it was such a chaotic thing that it was quite by chance that we came across anybody, virtually, until Dunkirk, of course. And then during the Dunkirk evacuation, there was a lot of activity.
Did you operate over Dunkirk?
Yes, we did, yes.
Can you describe in detail what actually happened to you over Dunkirk?
I think that the first thing, of course, was the tremendous feeling of shock and sympathy for the crowded beaches and, if you like, the dawning realisation that this was deadly serious when I one passed over Calais itself, and there was the sort of Rialto cinema on fire, and you thought, my goodness, that could be Bromley or something, or cinema. And you really began to take it seriously then.
Was that Calais or Dunkirk?
That was Calais itself. That, but one was sweeping mainly inland from Dunkirk because there was no point in hanging about over the beaches and waiting for chaps to finish their bombing run or something. You wanted to get at them before they got there. So we were inland most of the time from Dunkirk, patrolling round at the back.
Would this explain why so many of the British Army people complained about the supposed absence of the RAF?
Oh, I think very probably so, yes. But there was no point in fighting over their heads after all. It was rather too late in the day.
Did you have any successes over Dunkirk?
Personally, no. I can't recall shooting anything down at that particular time. There was a lot of activity. No, it was after Dunkirk that I finally got my next German.
We'll come on to that in a minute, but did you think that there was any difference in experience or skill between the RAF and the Luftwaffe over France in 1940?
Oh, I think they were very much more experienced, and I don't know how many of them had been in the Condor Legion in Spain, but of course we reckon that quite a number of them had had battle experience beforehand. In fact, we had a pilot who joined 32 Squadron who was, I think, Belgian, the Baron de Grun, who had flown 109s with the Condor Legion in Spain. And then he came to us, and rather amusingly, as it so happens, he told us all the advantages and disadvantages of the 109 and how best to defeat it. But he was the first chap we had shot down by a 109. So we didn't think his knowledge was all that good, necessarily.
Do you remember what he told you about its advantages and disadvantages?
Yes, he was the advantages were speed in dive and rate of roll and zoom climb, but poor in turns, in turning circle. And level flight speed, not a great deal of difference between the Hurricane and the 109.
So what did that mean in terms of tactics?
Tactically, that meant that if, of course, you force them into a turning battle, their game was to try and bounce you from above and go straight past taking a shot at you and continue on down in a dive, and then which you couldn't catch them in, and then do a zoom climb back upstairs again to have another go. But if you could get them into a turning battle, then, of course, you could turn inside them with no great difficulty.
So you had to try to approach them from height?
Or make sure that when they came down you were able to turn and outwit them in that way, turn out of their line of fire, and hope that rather than pass on, having had a shot at you, you hope they'd mix it. And if they mixed it with you, you were then in a good situation.
Can you say, in general terms, what you thought of the Hurricane as a fighter during the war?
Oh, it was a very fine fighter aircraft. It was very tough, very rugged, took a lot of battle damage. It was a very good, steady gun platform, and was ideal, of course, for the sort of odd, rough fields we operated from in France, these sort of little flying club airfields, grass airfields and so on, because it had a wide undercarriage. which made it very stable on the ground for landing and takeoff. It wasn't as delicate as the Spitfire in that way.
We hear about all these different marks of Spitfire. Mm. Were there different marks of Hurricane as well?
Oh, yes, yes. These were the Hurricane 1s and the Hurricane 2s in those days. But they were in a constant state of development, in that we started off with, just before the war, with wooden fixed bit chair screws, and then, of course, when the war came, we firstly got two pit chair screws, and then de Havilland metal ones, and then eventually wooden Rotol variable pit chair screws, which were enhanced the performance very greatly indeed.
Did you see any German strafing of refugees in France?
No, one heard about it and saw results of it in the way of shot up vehicles and that sort of thing, but I didn't actually witness any of it myself.
What did you see of the shot up refugees?
Oh, things like cars, trucks that people had been using, dead horses that were towing farm carts full of belongings and things like that.
What did the RAF men think of those tactics? Did they think that it was wrong or that it was fair enough?
No, we were horrified at that sort of thing, shooting up defenceless people. I suppose that you could argue the Germans had a case to try and clear the roads for their advance, but I personally wouldn't have said that was a very good way to do it. It merely added to the confusion, which perhaps that was their idea.
Do you think that between the air crews of the two sides in the Battle for France, that the battle was fought fairly, or were there any deplorable tactics like shooting at descending parachutists?
No, we never encountered any of that ourselves. Later on in the war, there was during the Battle of Britain, there was the odd case reported, but I never personally knew of anybody who had been shot up on a parachute.
Did you see anything of the Allied air forces, like the French, Belgians?
Yes, to our horror, one of the days we were in France, we'd landed and were refuelling, and a German bomber, Dornier 17, flew over the airfield at about 2,000 feet. And fortunately, he didn't take any notes of us. He was bound somewhere else, presumably. And there was a French aircraft, French fighter, doing aerobatics over the airfield. And we shouted furiously at the French squadron commander to get on the radio and tell him about this Dornier 17. And to our surprise, the French squadron commander said that this pilot was only authorised for aerobatics that morning and not for combat, which didn't impress us very much.
Was your opinion of the French wholly negative, or did you come across anything admirable from them in the Battle for France?
They were wholly unhelpful, I found.
Why did you think that was? Did you have any idea?
No, I think they were demoralised. They had very poor equipment in those days. Their aircraft were old-fashioned and totally outclassed. Their morale really was non-existent. And, of course, they'd suffered so heavily in the First War, I think, that they were almost disinterested in the Second One.
Did you have any contact with French civilians with whom you spoke?
No, I didn't. Only through my chum, who was a fluent French speaker, who used to try and get food for us. But of course, we were there on the airfield during the day, and then we were back home again at night. And it was merely that we never got anything to eat or drink over there during the day, between sort of dawn and dusk when we left.
So you didn't get any impression of what their attitude towards the RAF might have been?
No.
Are there any other incidents in the Battle for France that stick out in your mind?
No particular instance, I don't think, no. It was just one of general frustration over the chaos that existed, and the fact that we felt we weren't being used to maximum extent, because arriving at an airfield and refueling yourselves and then finding you get no instructions over the telephone to say, right, let's go and patrol somewhere and see if we can find the enemy, and go off and have a luckless search and arrive back and go through the same routine again, seemed to us to be a total waste of time.
Did you know that there was an RAF policy for not sending Spitfires to France?
I didn't know of it as such, no. But firstly, of course, there weren't all that number of Spitfires available. The ratio of Hurricanes to Spitfires was something of the order of two Hurricanes to one Spitfire, I think. And I would have said it was rather an unsuitable aircraft. It was a higher performance aircraft than the Hurricane, and I think it would have been rather wasteful, because it wouldn't have taken to the rough ground as readily as the Hurricane did, and I think we probably would have broken more of them unnecessarily.
Can you tell me about any particular personalities who stand out in your mind, whom you worked with at this time of 1940 from Biggin Hill?
At Biggin Hill, are you thinking of? Or
any others?
Yes. At Biggin Hill, oh yes, the station commander was a splendid chap, Dick Grice, who he was promoted group captain sometime after the war had started, and otherwise it had been a wing command station, and he was a great ball of fire, actually. And later on, when the Germans started bombing the airfield and bombed Biggin Hill, he decided that because they'd done no damage, there were a lot of holes in the grass and that sort of thing, but no real basic damage, he reckoned that they'd send a reconnaissance aircraft over the next day, and having seen there was no damage, would have another go. So he got the local army to blow the hangars up. And we weren't using the hangars anyway, because they were an obvious target. We were dispersed on the far side of the airfield and were doing all our maintenance over there. So he had the hangars blown down and got a bill from the Air Ministry about 2 years later for which, of course, he could not afford to pay.
Now, after the Battle for France, can you tell me what happened to you personally?
After France, yes, we then had a period where we were either doing bomber escort, Blenheims bombing, marshalling yards and that sort of thing in France, and we were also doing patrols, what we called offensive patrols, at about 15,000 feet, penetrating down into France and then coming back up the coast. And the snag about it was that, of course, the Germans took no notice of you on the way in, and they waited till you were on the way home when they knew you were getting short of fuel, and also the sun was behind you, so they could then take off and climb up and attack you from behind when you were on the way home. And these became, we decided, were a terrible waste of time, because all we did was suffer casualties and not have very much success. And finally, fortunately, one day, Stuffy Darding himself came down to Manston, where we were, and we were operating from Manston at that particular day, and we complained bitterly to him, and he grunted and said nothing. And next day, the whole series was cancelled. We had protested very volubly about it as being putting us in a very difficult situation altogether, and not achieving anything. We were supposed to be persuading the Germans to come up and fight, and they didn't bother until they got us at a disadvantage.
Were the Blenheims easy meat for the Germans?
Yes, I suppose so, but they weren't attacked very much. They suffered more from flak, from anti-aircraft damage, they seemed to. Because the anti-aircraft defences were quite heavy, and we saw several of them that were shot up, and they flew in very close formation, and on on one occasion one aircraft was hit and swung into another one so that they both collided and went down. But we were sitting up above to protect them from fighters, and we didn't see any fighters, and of course the anti-aircraft didn't bother with us.
When was the series of raids that Dowding cancelled approximately?
Oh, this was the sort of period June, 10th of June to about the end of June, that sort of period. Beginning of July or so.
How did the Battle of Britain start, as far as you remember?
Well, it was really a continuation, if you like, after Dunkirk, when we were admittedly over the other side, and then it became a case of us sitting on the ground and until we were scrambled for an incoming raid. But it started very much with sort of odd aircraft, German, I think probably reconnaissance aircraft, and odd bombers who were making use of cloud cover and so on, coming over to test the defences. There were many times one was scrambled and never saw anything, never found anything. Or, as I see looking at my logbook, intercepting an X-raid, but we lost the Dornier 17 in cloud. Never made contact with him.
What did you think of the German tactics during the Battle of Britain?
They were pretty good, on the whole. They, of course, they had their large numbers. Their fighter escort wasn't all that effective to start off with. They were under difficulties. They were being forced to fly at bomber speed. They were, of course, at very much at extending their range. They couldn't stay around and play for long with 109s, or they weren't going to have fuel to get home again. But they were, if you like, a source of trouble in this respect, that if we did an interception on a bomber formation and A flight would go in to do their attack, followed by us in B flight, and before we could get in, down would come the 109s from above. And we found that we were nearly always involved in fighting off the 109s and trying to deflect them, while safe flight were having their shots at the bombers. And that's the way it seemed to go.
Again, can I ask you the question I asked about France, about numerical superiority in the Battle of Britain?
Oh, yes. That, by then one realised the tremendous preponderance of numbers they'd got. And of course, they were very confident, the Germans, that it was only a question of time. One of them, whom we shot down near the airfield, we brought him. He was locked up in the guardroom, and when we finished flying that night, we got him over to the mess for a drink, and he was a very arrogant young man who said, could he ask for a pen and paper so that he could make a note of our names to ensure that we were well treated when the